session.
You stay seated. Thanks. Jacobs.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming back. These next few topics are common theme topics. They're going to go fairly quickly. I'm going to start with the accusation that we wasted $150,000 or stole $150,000 by commissioning the Gazella painting. Now, you recall this morning I showed you some minutes, CABN minutes, where the commissioning of that painting and prints were discussed. Back on January 5th, a former FBI agent, Kathleen McAfee, testified. And she testified in part about this painting and those prints. You may recall that I did some clumsy arithmetic with her. I was trying to multiply 500 times 600, and I was coming out with 30,000, when it should have obviously been 300,000. And 500 times 500 and 250,000, trying to figure out how much these prints would sell for. That's what we were trying to do. And when I asked her if any of that happened, she said no. And when I asked her why, she said, not I said, she said because of the investigation. And that's absolutely right. She admitted the painting exists, that the painting was at the Seaport Museum, that it cost $150,000, that the deal was made by a reputable art dealer, a fellow by the name of Reese Pally, who for a long time had a very prominent art store on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. Now, Tuesday afternoon, Mr. Zausmer said to you that this whole topic of prints of this painting being sold was an afterthought. That's something that we cooked up after the investigation started. Then he came back Wednesday, and he tried to retreat from that position, probably realizing that Government Exhibit 1426 completely contradicts that type of thinking. Now, if we look at 1426, we see, Mary, we're going to look at 1426, and we're going to see that this was no afterthought. Here is the agreement, and it's between John Stobart, the artist, and Reese Pally, who is an art dealer. So we didn't just go out without sufficient experience and make some crazy deal with some crazy artist. We had an art dealer represent us, and you'll see it's a $150,000 painting. That's a significant amount of money for a painting, and we're paying $20,000 for the services of the art dealer. And the dates here, if we can go up a little more, Mary, we see that $10,000 was paid to him on, paid to somebody on June 13th, 05, but the day somebody signed, that is a representative. Sandra Heafy is a representative of the artist. So artists have, like, agents. So we have art dealer dealing with the agent for the artist is what this is all about. The agent for the artist signs on December 3, 03, Reese Pally signs on our behalf. He's our agent. Signs on our behalf January 15th, 2004. And the Inquirer article, as I remember it, was January 25, 2004, if I remember that correctly. Now, Mary, if we can go to the first page of the actual agreement, the work of art agreement. Page after this. That's it. Here's the work of art agreement, and it says February 4, but as Mr. Zausmer conceded yesterday, that's obviously 2004. Now, my interest here is in the first paragraph, topic heading prints. So if we can go up a bit more, Mary, and we've highlighted some of this. And what this does is it tells you the print deal. And the print deal, which was always an integral part of this agreement, the preceding paragraph talks about the painting. It's going to be a 24 by 36-inch painting of the Gazella in a rendering determined by the artist's soul and absolute discretion. And then it goes into the prints. And what it says is the artist grants an exclusive license to the client, that's us, to produce a limited number of prints. And I don't have to read every word here, but there's two types of prints. Museum quality acid-free archival paper, and that's the collector edition, and then a special archival paper, that's the museum edition. And the artist, I think we have this highlighted here. No, we don't. The artist shall hand-sign each print, and he gets a royalty for doing that. The royalty is in paragraph 4D on the next page. He gets 5% of the sales price of each print. Then if you look at the next paragraph, you see the pricing. The pricing is $600 for the collector edition. $600 retail, $300 wholesale. And the museum quality, $1,000 retail and $500 wholesale. Now, no matter how you do the arithmetic, you know, 500 times 1,000, that's $500,000. You know, 500 times 600, I now know is $300,000. No matter how you do the arithmetic, there's a lot of money in these prints. The deal here is really the prints. If you know just a little bit about art, you know that if you're a good enough artist to have an agent and to sell your paintings for $150,000, if you're that well-respected when you're alive, your paintings may well cost a lot more when you're dead because you can't paint anymore, and it's simply supply and demand. But that's the small part of it. Who knows if the painting will go up 5% or 10% or 100%, but the prints are another matter, and they can make you a lot of money. Now, that's what this deal was all about. It is simply incorrect to say that Tracy Burris stumbled over the prints one day. The prints have always been stored at Citizens Warehouse. It was always the intent to sell the prints and make a lot of money. And this is emblematic. Even this effort, this creative effort, to have citizens buy a piece of art, display it in a public museum, commission the prints, have the artist sign the prints, over a period of time market the prints, and make a lot of money along the way. If anybody else did it, they'd be called a genius, a hero. This guy is contributing to the arts in Philadelphia. Isn't this wonderful? Plus, along the way, Citizens Alliance is benefiting by hundreds of thousands of dollars. Anybody else did it, they get a pat on the back. Senator Fumo does it, he gets an indictment. Now, a part of the reason for this is what I said yesterday, and this, again, is emblematic. There doesn't seem to be room in the collective federal investigator head for the proposition that the project of commissioning this painting of that ship and working out the deal for the prints and the signing, it may have multiple purposes. Admittedly, a purpose is Senator Fumo likes maritime art. He has lots of it in his house. He likes it. He enjoys it. He collects it. So part of the purpose for doing this is certainly that he's knowledgeable about it and he enjoys it. But that's not the end of it. In the collective federal investigator head, that's the end of it. We are stealing $150,000because we are doing this just for Senator Fumo to enjoy it. They don't have room to allow for the rest of it. Citizens Alliance can sell these prints and make hundreds of thousands of dollars. Who would get that money? Real Property 6, as you'll see from Exhibit 1426, is the owner of the painting and the owner of the prints. So as these prints sell for $500 each or $1,000 each or whatever it is, as these prints sell, that enriches Citizens Alliance. They make more and more and more money. The simple truth here is that there are at least two reasons to do this. Yet another reason is to promote maritime art. Now, maybe the Seaport Museum doesn't want the painting anymore, but they had it for a time and hung it for a time. And if you read this agreement, you'll see that there was a whole a series of events that were to take place over the promotion of this painting. So in reality, this entire transaction was motivated not just to enrich Senator Fumo. This transaction was motivated to make a lot of money, to give a valuable asset to citizens, and to make a lot of money as we progressively sold these prints. And the only reason we couldn't selectively sell these prints is everybody got scared by the investigation. As Senator Fumo said, the artist's representative agent wouldn't even talk to us. And that's why we still have the valuable prints sitting in the citizens' warehouse. And hopefully when this is over, we will sell them all. And that money will not go to Senator Fumo's pocket. That money will go to citizens. And regrettably, the artist will die one day. And when he dies, in all likelihood, this painting will be more valuable. And we can sell that and make a lot more money. So the fact that Senator Fumo has an interest in this type of art and may have gotten a little bit of enjoyment about it doesn't turn it into a crime. Now, Matthew Fonseca, the erstwhile polo player and valet, says he saw this painting hanging in the foyer of Senator Fumo's home in the summer of 2004. The problem with that is, I, knowing that was incorrect, I went and got the framing bill, and I asked him if he saw it hanging, sitting there on an easel, framed. And he said, oh, absolutely, a big frame. Well, it wasn't even framed till November. It simply was never in Senator Fumo's house. He said that. The framing bill supports that. And even if it was, so what? Big deal. It was there for a while. It doesn't change the economics of the situation. The economics of the situation are that he got a good idea for citizens to make a lot of money. They would have made a lot of money. It was just frustrated by this investigation. It's an example of there being more than one purpose for something occurring. Jubilee litigation. Howard Kane testified about this on November 10th. And he said this was discussed among himself, Senator Fumo, maybe Paul Dugalecki, maybe Chris Craig, not Ruth Arnao. Counsel calls it a spite suit. And again, because they can only see it one way. Senator Fumo's a Democrat. Jubilee is a Republican. It's got to be a spite suit. Because all Republicans have to hate all Democrats, and everything he does is evil. So it's got to be everything he does. So it's a spite suit. In reality, that's the radical approach. Here's the reasonable approach. When John Lawless testified on December 2nd, he told you he was a former legislator himself and a Republican, just like Jubilee. But he believed that Senator Fumo was correct, that this was a serious constitutional problem under the Pennsylvania Constitution. He believed it was wrong for another Republican to be in the executive and the legislature at the same time. Think back to your civics. I mean, the first thing that drum into your head in seventh or eighth grade is that you got three branches of government, all separate of equal authority. So John Lawless, a fellow Republican, agrees with Senator Fumo on this constitutional issue. And he joins the suit because he wants to press the constitutional question. He wants to do the right thing. Cross-examining Senator Fumo on this, counsel produces the complaint and says, look at this paragraph of the complaint. Doesn't it say that if you win, Senator Jubilee has to give up a seat? Yes. That's the whole point. That's the whole constitutional issue. If Senator Jubilee gets promoted to lieutenant governor, he's now in the executive. The whole point here is, under the Constitution, which has three separate parts of government, he would have to give up the Senate seat. That's the whole point. I don't know what the intent of posing that question was. We all know that. He's got to take one or the other. Now, just because Jubilee is a Republican, this becomes part of our theft. Now we're stealing the $20,000 or $17,000 after Howard Kane got done skimming $3,000 off it. Now we're accused of stealing that also. We're stealing this money. Counsel used the name, the phrase swiped. Howard Kane, government witness, swiped $3,000 off the top. And indeed he did. But that is a government witness. And he comes in with his own baggages, having been a tax cheat for all those years. But he did that. So they're accusing us of stealing or stealing $20,000 or stealing $17,000. And if it is booked, as a consulting fee, that information would only come from Howard Kane. That's the explanation for that. So here again, you have human conduct, the institution of this litigation. And admittedly, Senator Fumo doesn't want to be a lightning rod. He wants this litigated, but his official position as a senator is just decide the issue. We don't care who wins or loses. But before he can take that official position, somebody's got to start the lawsuit. So in his view, this is an appropriate not-for-profit expenditure by Citizens Alliance. You can agree with that or disagree with that, but it doesn't make it a crime. So he wants the constitutional litigation commenced. A Republican, a guy on the other side of the aisle, agrees it should be commenced. When it is commenced, Senator Fumo joins as an amicus, a friend of the court, saying just decide the issue quickly. He doesn't want the distraction of exactly what was said in this courtroom. It's a spite suit. That's exactly what he's trying to avoid, exactly what they said. So here, you've got a good, solid issue that should be decided by the courts. And again, one legislator in Pennsylvania has the brains and the courage to set it in motion. One guy out of everybody in the House of Representatives, everybody in the Senate, one guy says this ought to be teed off and decided by a court. That one guy is Senator Fumo. Instead of getting a pat on the back, he gets an indictment. Because in the collective federal mind, they cannot understand that there may be multiple motivations for the same human conduct here. Some benign, maybe some spiteful. In this case, it really is hard to understand. Nobody's denying that there is a serious constitutional issue. Nobody's denying that he's the only one who tackled it. But in the face of those undeniable facts, they still say we're stealing. They still say it's all spite. Bar review courses. In quick summary, Citizens Alliance paid a grand total of $11,000. Two $4,000 checks to Christian Marone, one to Dan Coyne. These guys were young lawyers. They were working for the Senate. They were doing incidental work, as everybody did, for Senator Fumo politically, personally, Citizens Alliance. They were part of the team. As young lawyers, they had to graduate law school, they had to take a bar review course, then they had to take the bar review. Christian Marone comes to Senator Fumo, and he makes a pitch. The pitch is other Senate employees or other government employees get tuition assistance, yet it's not part of our package, our compensation package. What can you do for me? Senator Fumo says, you're right, it's not part of your compensation package, but maybe we can work something out. Didn't you work? You're a Senate employee, but didn't you work on two Citizens Alliance projects? Didn't you work on the Passyunk Avenue revitalization? Didn't you work on the incubator project? Now, you know the answer is yes. And you heard Christian Marone testify about all the work he did on those two projects. In fact, he claimed that he was the one who accumulated what he referred to as the critical mass of properties on Passyunk Avenue. And he told you that he did an awful lot developing the incubator project at 201 Spring Garden. And he went on and on and on. So clearly he worked. And these are citizens' projects. Properly, Senator Fumo says, we'll pay you for that. Now, the wrinkle here arises because Christian Marone is making the pitch for himself and for his friend Dan Coyne. Dan Coyne did not work on those projects. Christian Marone did. So Senator Fumo got him two $4,000 checks, and the rest was up to him. Now, we don't know who reported what on their income tax. That's not our problem. The problem here is whether it was proper or improper for Citizens Alliance to give tuition aid to two young people, working in the Senate office in Philadelphia? And the answer is yes, it's right in our purposes, promoting education. Our biggest single expenditure is education. We're the people who set up the two charter schools, Christopher Columbus Charter School, $5.5 million. We're the people who bankrolled the Independence Charter School. So here, clearly, Senator Fumo is trying to help two young people, two aspiring lawyers, two Senate employees become lawyers. And in his judgment, a correct judgment, it's an absolutely proper expenditure for Citizens Alliance. Checks are written. They go take the courses. Dan Coyne doesn't do so well. He fails. He comes back, and he wants to do it a second time. This is the Dan Coyne that Senator Fumo encouraged to be a lawyer. This is the Dan Coyne that unfortunately got very ill. This is the Dan Coyne that Senator Fumo got a doctor for. This is the Dan Coyne that Senator Fumo paid all the doctors uninsured medical fees. That Dan Coyne. Senator Fumo says, okay, we'll pay the second time. Give us an invoice. Government Exhibit 1284 is Dan Coyne's invoice. And it's troubling because it's a bogus invoice. You will remember, and if you don't remember, I encourage you to please check your notes carefully. I asked Dan Coyne directly and bluntly, you tell me who got the idea of making up this bogus invoice. The answer was, I did, Mr. Jacobs. He did it himself. Senator Fumo wasn't asking for a bogus invoice. You take a bar review course, you get an invoice. He said, get an invoice, and Dan Coyne clearly said this was his idea and nobody else. And he gave Jamie Spagna a bogus invoice. What does Jamie Spagna know? And that's how it gets paid. Now, Christian Marone, an embittered son-in-law, did his very best to dirty this up. But that's what he was. He was an embittered son-in-law. So here again, what are the motivations? On the one hand, you've got the government saying, here's another example of Senator Fumo being enriched at the expense of Citizens Alliance. How is that? He didn't get a nickel of Christian Marone's two $4,000 checks or a nickel of Dan Coyne's $3,000 check. Yet they say he stole that. He didn't steal it. He requested or directed that a not-for-profit whose purposes include furthering education absorb the bills for these two young men. And they did it. Again, you've got a radical explanation. This is a theft. This is a part of $1.5 million theft. And you've got a rational explanation. He's trying to help the two young men get through the bar exam so they can become something. And they did. And they did. Christian Marone, whatever else he is, and that is entirely up to you, he's making himself a fine career. Working as a lawyer in Washington because Senator Fumo helped him get past the bar exam. And what does he get for that? Indicted. And by the way, it was November 24th that Dan Coyne told me that it was he who made up that invoice. Cuba. Clearly not in Philadelphia, but we dealt with that this morning. Clearly within our authority, because we are permitted, in plain understandable English, to engage in any activities not prohibited by the IRS. And that language appears in three different versions throughout our corporate documents, and it's simply undeniable. Now, how does the Cuba issue arise? Senator Arlen Specter, famous guy, Warren Commission lawyer, calls Senator Fumo and tells him, here's what's happening with the embargo. There is this group, this Cuban alliance. There's this guy, Al Fox, and they have a federal license to travel to Cuba to indoctrinate people or enlighten people as the effects of the embargo. So maybe there will be some public sentiment in favor of lifting this embargo in the coming years. Would you like to go? That's how it all starts, with a federal senator calling Senator Fumo. Now, look at this exhibit. Can we see 1251? This is a November 10, 2001 memoranda about this Cuba trip, November 1720. And it's from Al Fox, and it's, I guess, everybody who's going. And would you go up a little bit? Look at the highlighted part. This is pretty blunt and direct. Please have clarity. This is not a vacation. There will be no time for fishing, golfing, scuba diving, or other recreational activities. This is not what the federal prosecutors wanted you to know. This is as much work as it is play. It's a lot more work than it is play. Let's go to the next page of this. All right, we have the next page. Here's the itinerary that they send around. Let's scope this out. 3 days, well, 3.5 days. Here's some excerpts. Meet with Miguel Alvarez, editor to Cuban National, advisor to Cuban National Assembly President Ricardo Alarcón. All right, so you meet with a high-ranking Cuban official. Meet with Pedro Alvarez or a deputy at Aliport, Cuba's agricultural import agency. So now you learn about what they can and can't import. Tour the Latin American School of Medicine, which they're very proud of. The next day, church services. After that, meeting with a Cuban dissident. Now that sounds like a very informative thing to do. Briefing by the U.S. Interest Section, the closest we have to an ambassador in Cuba. Visit an agricultural cooperative, so now we know how they farm. Meeting with George Bolanos, former Cuban ambassador to Mexico. Next day, a presentation on drug interdiction in Cuba. You know, from other writings, that they brag, Al Fox brags, we have no drug problem in Cuba. They're going to teach you how. Visit the Havana port facilities. Havana is a major port, and it's not that far. It's on the same coast as us. Meeting with Ministry of Foreign Investment. You heard testimony. The Italians are there. The Germans are there. The Dutch are there. The Spanish are there. Europe is investing in Cuba, and they're 3,000 miles away. And we're not, and it's 90 miles from Florida. Briefing on terrorism. Meeting with the Minister of Tourism. Cuba used to be a major tourist destination. Dinner with several Cuban officials. Briefing on the status of U.S.-Cuba relations. Meeting with the Ministry of Education. Does that sound like fun? This is not a vacation. This is work. Plus, you pay your own way. You pay your own flight to get to the kickoff point in Florida. You pay for your hotel. You pay for your meals. Now, Senator Fumo told you, and common sense tells you, that thinking of the future, you may agree or disagree with the embargo, but if the embargo is lifted, Philadelphia will be a beneficiary. He knew that because he worked out a similar deal with Chile, having Chile ship fruits, vegetables, produce up to Philadelphia. More of that, more jobs. But the government can't understand that. There's not room in the collective federal investigative head to understand that, yeah, maybe it's true that he's getting to go to Havana and some influential friends of his are getting to go to Havana. Maybe that's true, but it's also true that there is a very important reason that they're doing this, important to Philadelphia. This is a bona fide organization. Can we see 1257? See if you can get into the margin of 1257, the left-hand margin. Look at these names. This is not Apple Tours here. This is no vacation. This is not Club Med. Look at these people. United States House of Representatives, Beryl Anthony. United States House of Representatives, Jack Bucher. Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Arnold Burns, House of Representatives, Rod Chandler, United States Senate, Dennis DeConcini, Special Assistant to President Corner, James C. Free, United States House of Representatives, Bruce Morrison. Former Secretary of the United States Senate, Walter Stewart. It's a very strong, these are serious people, very strong federal presence here. You know, Mr. Zausmer, he can poo-poo this all he wants. He says the embargo is already 50 years old. He makes it sound like pie in the sky that the embargo is going to be lifted because it's been there 50 years. Yeah. The Romans were throwing Christians to the lions for more than 50 years, but that stopped. And it also didn't make it right while they were doing it. It's not pie in the sky. I don't know if you read the same newspaper as I read, but you pick up a newspaper just this week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. There were
articles. Objection, Your Honor.
The same.
You will read the newspapers from time to time about the public sentiment about lifting the embargo. It is there. Just keep your eyes open. Look at some past newspapers. Look at newspapers published
objection,
today, tomorrow, the next day. It is.
What's the basis of the objection?
Asking for someone to look at newspapers during the trial regarding an issue before the jury.
We told them, of course, not to look at the newspapers regarding this trial.
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
When you look in the newspapers, don't read about this trial. Look for embargo articles, which is what I'm talking about.
Your Honor, same thing. That's not appropriate, Your Honor.
The point is this.
Objection, Your Honor.
The point is this. There is enormous public interest in this issue. Enormous public interest. You must know, if you watch CNN or C-SPAN or anything else, about the sentiment about the Cuban population in Florida controlling the issue.
Objection, Your Honor.
The objection is overruled. As I said in one of the objections counsel made to your arguments, Mr. Zausmer, that I thought it was fair commentary. But what I, as I also told the jury, it doesn't matter whether I thought it was fair or not, or whether I thought that the inference was a reasonable one to draw. It's entirely up to them. That's if they want to draw any inference from this stuff that Mr. Jacobs or you were saying. Okay? Members of the jury understand what I'm saying? Okay.
Thank you, Judge. This is an enormously important issue to millions of people. People in Florida see it one way. People in the rest of the country see it another way. The Cubans see it another way, all 37 million of them. This is something that some not-for-profit should fund, should take an interest in. And all Senator Fumo did is he gets this not-for-profit to contribute to that not-for-profit. He doesn't get a nickel out of it. And neither does anybody who went there. In fact, it costs some money. And yet that becomes, in the collective federal investigative mind, a crime. Part of the $1.5 million theft, part of the $1.5 million fraud committed against Citizens Alliance by criminal Vincent Fumo and criminal Ruth Arneo. It's hard to understand, ladies and gentlemen. They even complain that he recruited his friends to go. Who should he have recruited? His enemies? His friends happen to be a wide assortment of successful, important, influential people. One friend owns an internet company, Carmen DeCamillo. Another friend has a history working in construction, now with the DRPA, previously with Keating and Company, previously with some improvement authority in Atlantic County. Another friend has a florist shop, and he thought, correctly or incorrectly, this could be an opportunity, a post-embargo opportunity. He's also criticized because when somebody canceled out, Ruth told one of the persons who went to Cuba, Mr. Gross, that he could select somebody to go with him. So we're criticized for that. He selects a lawyer to go with him for 3 days. Now, one might wonder why he would voluntarily want to spend 3 days with a lawyer. But it's not the craziest selection in the world. I mean, these are legal issues. We're not spending money to send a local barber or a bunch of college kids to Havana for a hoop. That's not what this is about. This is a very important public issue that should be funded by some public interest corporation, and we were it. yet it becomes a crime. So the radical way to look at it is another example of us stealing money from Citizens Alliance. A rational way to look at it is a strongly federal personnel-backed organization looking for influential people to educate on what this is all about, send them back home, let them talk it up. You know, there's no law that says you have to come back from Havana and go on the radio and talk about your experience any more than if you went to some educational seminar in Dallas, Texas, for 3 days to learn more about your profession. You don't have to come back and write a book about it or go on the radio or TV about it, nor do you have to contribute to the group. The object here, the Cuban Alliance Group, they want Americans who of some substance, who contribute to political parties, who speak to legislators, they want to educate them on the embargo. And that's what we help do. The War Dog Memorial. The radical view of this is exactly what was expressed by Mr. Pease on October 22nd. It is a statue of a dog. That's the radical view. The rational view of this is, and may we see 975-02, Defense Exhibit 975-02. Can we make it a little bigger so we can read, maybe? That's good. Thank you. The rational view of this is this is a response of an elected official, Senator Fumo, to a plea made by veterans, people who were in uniform, who want recognition for themselves and their partners. That's how canine cops and military people working with dogs refer to them, partners. They live together, literally. For service in 9 conflicts spanning 90 years. I mean, it's not asking a lot. It is placed, and let's take a look at this. See the statue of the soldier, his partner? World War I, II, Korean War, Vietnam War, Gulf War, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, global war on terrorism, that covers a lot of ground. A lot of veterans, a lot of service. And all they want is a memorial. That's all they want. Now, can we see the other view of this? O-1, I believe. Yes, O-1. 975-01. Make that a little bigger. And it is part of a greater memorial. This is the Vietnam Memorial. All gave some gave all. Very touching. The veterans want to be a part of this. And can we look at 975-03? Recognition is given to the people who helped raise the money. And certainly Senator Fumo is one. Can we make that bigger? But another is Senator Robert Tommy Tomlinson, the opposite guy that Christian Marone told you Senator Fumo was doing this to help. The opposite guy. Now, this idea comes to Senator Fumo through a politician, through a local politician. So what? Isn't this how the country is supposed to work? You, a citizen, you want to get something done. Aren't you supposed to go to your elected officials? I mean, don't we have what they taught us in school is a representative form of government? So aren't you supposed to go, if you need something done in your city, to one of the councilmen? And if you need something done in your county, to one of the board of freeholders? If you need something done in the state, to one of the representatives of one of the senators? Isn't that the way representative government is supposed to work? Nothing different happened here. Veterans went to a politician and said, we need some help. We want to be part of the Vietnam Memorial. We are veterans. We want our partners and us acknowledged. We've been through nine wars. You know, we need $100,000 raised. Can you help? That's what happened here. But again, because the contact between the veterans and Senator Fumo was a politician, the government can only see this as a crime, a $50,000 theft to enrich Senator Fumo, who did not get a penny out of it, but this is part of the $1.5 million that we stole from Citizens Alliance. Because anything he touches, even something this noble, is immediately infected and becomes criminal. They can't understand that at the same moment in time, he is also doing something very, very good for some people who are very, very deserving. They can't understand that there may be two or three or four purposes for any human conduct. I want to move on to the topic of the Ventnor Dunes. And I'd like to get up on the screen Government Exhibit 1226, which you're going to see is a fax communication. And the point I want to make to you here is there are a couple lawyers working on this. Lisa Petkin, who testified, she was the Citizens Alliance lawyer, and Christopher, I believe you know, is Christopher Craig, Senate attorney. So you've got two lawyers working on this project. Now, what is this project? This is another area where there are at least two things going on. Sure, it is true. It is definitely true that Margate is next to Ventnor. It is definitely true that this Dune project is proposed for Ventnor. And it is possible that another proposal might be made for Margate. And we know that Senator Fumo has a residence in Margate. And we know it's on the beach block. And yes, it can be argued that he has a private interest here, because if a second proposal is made and if it is constructed, then it might create some obstruction for him of the beach or the ocean. Those things are true. Here's what's also true. A real live witness came in here, a fellow by the name of Herbert Cook. December 2nd, Mr. Cook testified. Mr. Cook is obviously an affluent guy, an older guy. He owned a company and sold it, made a lot of money. And he contributed $10,000 to this project because he says this area is South Philly in the summer. And I don't know if you go there. I don't know if you go to Ventnor or Margate or Longport. But it is South Philly in the summer. There's probably more Philadelphia people than there are year-round residents. So he contributes $10,000 to the project. He believes on it. In it, Howard Kane is working on it, Senator Fumo, Dottie Eggrey, Ken Snyder. Ruth was not involved, but, you know, Senator Fumo and others were involved. Now, this is a situation where the radical view is Senator Fumo is stealing however much money the project costs, the donation, the printing, and everything. He's stealing that. Not a cent goes into his pocket, but they say he's stealing it. That's part of the $1.5 million. That's the radical view. The rational view is this. There are lots of Philadelphia people there, and the project was stupid. This is an Army Corps of Engineers make-work project, costing taxpayers millions of dollars. And everybody is predicting that it will have a lifespan of one storm. So they want to not waste the money. They want to not construct the dune. The dune is going to be ugly, and it's not going to last. Unfortunately, they lose the referendum. Millions of dollars are spent. The dune is constructed, and it immediately washes out. And the taxpayers lose millions of dollars. They had a bona fide issue. It was of importance to people from this area who vacationed there, and we're not bound to Philadelphia alone. Lisa Petkin knows what the restrictions are. She created the corporation. She wrote some of the bylaws, and she did all the legal work. if there were anything wrong with us being involved in this Ventnor project, the lawyer who created us would have said so. Now, Lisa Petkin, who testified on December 2nd, by the way, she referred to Citizens Alliance as a not very significant client, which was interesting. Not very significant client, which paid her $122,000. She acknowledged that Citizens Alliance paid all the bills for this Ventnor project. She also explained to you that lobbying is okay for a 501c3. She talked to you about the substantiality test. She told you she knew exactly what was going on as she was working with Chris Craig. There was no secret at all about this. And documentary proof of that exists in several places. For example, we have 1226B, second page. This is an email, government exhibit, and it's an email that is authored by Lisa to Chris Craig. And I don't know if we have a highlight. I may have to find my space here. Here we are. Okay, can you blow up this last paragraph? This is Lisa. And the reason I'm showing you this paragraph, I had to go scurry and find this, because if I understood Mr. Zausmer correctly, yesterday, the day before, he was claiming that Lisa didn't know what was going on with this Ventnor project. Maybe I misunderstood him, but I think he said that. Here's Lisa writing to Chris Craig, and she wants to know, first sentence, last paragraph, which organization is intended to get involved in the referendum? She's talking about the referendum in Ventnor on the dunes. So she clearly knew exactly what was going on. I'm not going to put these on the board for you, but I'll tell you what they are. And if you want, at some point, you can look at Government Exhibit 1224. It's a pack of bills and forwarding letters by this gigantic law firm, Pepper Hamilton, several hundred lawyers, to Ruth, the Citizens Alliance. And it makes it crystal clear that she knew exactly what was going on. So if any suggestion was made by Mr. Zausmer, I understood it, that she was somehow unaware of the Ventnor project. You'll find a September 13, 2002 letter to Ruth from Lisa, which says, enclosed are four invoices for services rendered through August 31, 2002 with regard to tax counseling, the Riparian Defense Fund, the Environmental Awareness Fund, and the Down Beach Community Corporation. I trust you find the bills in good order, signed by Lisa Petkin. That's exactly what's going on. Maybe I misheard him yesterday, but I do think I heard him say that she was somehow kept in the dark. And you'll also find a statement, August 31, 2001, which has a few charges on it. The first one is the Riparian Defense Fund, $1,499. You'll also find a January 14, 2002 letter addressed to Ruth, signed by Lisa, saying, enclosed is the firm's invoice for services rendered for the Down Beach Community Development Corporation through December 31, 2001. Lisa Petkin, the lawyer, knew exactly what was going on. And we had some discussion about, you know, the tidal waters and the ocean and this and that, but knew exactly what was going on. Now, so here again is an example. Oh, and by the way, Lisa Petkin told you it's common for one 501c3 to contribute to another 501c3. Now, the point was made yesterday by Mr. Zausmer that the Ventnor group had changed its name. There was something about Dune. Yep. If they weren't a 501c3 under the names in these bills, that's what they were trying to do. We're not responsible for, you know, what they called themselves when they published whatever they published. The point is, they were trying to operate as a 501c3. We contributed as a 501c3. Lisa Petkin says that's all absolutely fine, and there's nothing that enriched Senator Fumo. Now, while I have this file open, let me point something interesting out to you. And this is Government Exhibit 1226B. This is the first page, and I want to focus in on the center. You recall the testimony of Christopher Craig. And we can make that second paragraph bigger. Can we do that? Okay. Now, this is a little bit off the topic, but I think it's worth mentioning. Christopher Craig testified for quite some time, and he hopefully struck you as an intelligent person, an honest person, you know, all-around good lawyer. This is an email that he writes to Lisa Petkin, and what he is doing is he's trying to educate himself on 501c3s. And in some of these emails, in this part of the case, he's saying, I read some law review articles and, you know, I'm learning about this. But this will tell you how murky and confusing this area of the law is. You got an obviously intelligent lawyer here, and he writes to Lisa. This is after he's educating himself by reading law review articles, and I'll quote it. He writes, reference repairing defense fund, we have no such contemplation for the 501c3. I recognize that it is not permitted to engage in any form of political activity or lobbying. That's what Christopher Craig says, and he's completely wrong. Completely wrong. Smart lawyer, trying to educate himself on 501c3s, but he also has not read the IRS statutes and the IRS rules and the 990 instructions and so on, because he's got it all backwards. Small wonder that when the issue of polling was raised, and we're going to get to that, small wonder when the issue of polling was raised, there was a divergence of opinion among lawyers and among CPAs as to what the rules really were. He was a very smart lawyer, got it completely backwards. Now, that is a segue to the polling discussion. Now, this polling issue was discussed among Senator Fumo, Howard Kane, and Ken Snyder. Ruth was not a decision maker on these polls, and she never had the polls. Before I discuss it much with you, I would like to give you a little bit of a refresher on the email history of this situation. And can we start with Government Exhibit 1176, third page? Now, 1176 is a government exhibit. It's got 11 pages, and it's a string of emails. And on the third page, we should be looking at an email from Ken Snyder to Jeff Pollack. And without reading every word, you see what it says there. They're going to try to meet at Vince's house with Howard Kane there, and they're going to try to double team her into getting these polling invoices paid. We can go to 1182. I'm going to show you three government exhibits here, which show you what Ruth was trying to do once a question was raised about whether polling was a proper expense. Here in Exhibit 1182, Ruth is writing to Mr. Pollack, telling him, we shouldn't have paid your bill. Give the money back. 1345. Ruth is writing to Fumo for Senate, saying, we paid these bills and we shouldn't have. Give us the money. Government Exhibit 1185. Ruth gets the money back. She eventually gets it all back. Now, what's going on here? There's an investigation. An issue in the investigation is it proper or not proper for a not-for-profit to pay for polling? And nobody really knows the answer. No lawyer comes to grips with it. I just gave you an example of an erudite lawyer, Mr. Craig, who got it all wrong. So it's small wonder that some lawyer says to Senator Fumo, whether you're right or wrong, pay the money back, which he does. Which he does. Now, let's go to Exhibit 1346. This exhibit This is the instruction form for IRS Form 4720. Now, Mary, can we blow up this highlighted section? We have it? Okay. Now, this highlighted section tells you what some of the things that you do with this form. And what it talks about is a tax, the Section 4955 tax imposed on any amount paid or incurred by a 501c3 organization that participates or intervenes in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. That is the precise test. If you do something other than that, you're absolutely fine. So you can pull your head off on any issue you want, about any race you want. And many of these things were done years in advance. It's only when you get involved in a race for or against a candidate that you got a problem, because you're restricted on that. And to solve the problem, you file this form. You file this form, and you subject yourself to an excise tax. Now, off the track a little, but while we have it here, the second highlighted area deals with a Section 4958 tax. And this is on disqualified persons. What that really means is an insider. An organization managers of 501c3s that engage in excess benefit transactions. You heard that defined by CPAs. If the 501c3 gives you what you're entitled to, no problem. If they give you more than you're entitled to, it's an excess benefit transaction. And you subject yourself again by filing this form to an excise tax. Now, thank you. Take the form off. Now, what goes on here is there is a lengthy, lengthy discourse. Can we see 1348? Section, 1348 is a memo from a person identified to you as a, I'm sorry, let me interrupt myself for a moment. When I examined the CPAs on this 4720 form, I asked them if they were familiar with it, and the answer routinely was no. And I pointed out to them what the IRS says it takes to prepare this form. And I'm looking at page 8. It's Government Exhibit 1346. You can check me on this. And the time commitment to prepare this form, according to the IRS, is staggering. It adds up to 39 plus 18 is 57 plus 23. 80 hours. And I point that out to you because you're going to see as you review these exhibits that the tax expert, Joe Lundy, recommended preparation of the form. The accountants wouldn't tackle it. It was too much for them. All right, so here is this memo, the highlighted section. It's a phone conference. Joe Lundy, Stockton Bates CPA. I expressed Stockton Bates' concern about a possible excise tax liabilities and possible excess benefit transactions. He, that would be Joe Lundy, would advise citizens to file both Form 4720, excise tax, and Form 4958, excess benefit transactions, with zero liabilities. This is how the issue was framed among the lawyers and the CPAs, three CPAs and three lawyers. Can we go back to the date on that? As early as January 19, 2005, if you remember any of my examination, I tried to make it crystal clear that these polls were in the hands of the lawyers. The lawyers would not give them up to the CPAs. You cannot blame that on Ruth. She never had the polls. The lawyers and the CPAs were in a dispute over what should be done regarding polling expenses. Unfortunately, nobody took the time to sit down and double check what Joe Lundy said. Sounds like what he said is right. File the form, but tell your side of the story, that we didn't intervene, participate in any race on behalf or against anybody. But this went on for months and months and months. You can't blame Ruth because three lawyers on one side and three CPAs on the other side could not agree about what they should do regarding polling expenses. You've probably heard enough now to know and to understand that you're only in trouble with the IRS if what you're doing gets you into a race for or against somebody, with the possible exception of the Fitzpatrick poll, which the candidate said when she testified she never saw or knew about the polling. But the substance of the polling may have been communicated to her by Ken Snyder. Ken Snyder, by the way, is the person who said that not-for-profits do polling all the time. Now, it is absolutely true that the automated telephone calls in that campaign should not have been made. That was a mistake. That was clearly a mistake. And that is an oversight. The rest of these polling expenses are absolutely fine. There was no problem with them other than the indecision of the three lawyers and the three CPAs. Now, I mentioned Ken Snyder, who told you, aside from telling you, that not-for-profits do polling all the time, that some of these polls were done years in advance of an election. He gave you an example. The poll trying to figure out how people thought about the mayor was done 2 years in advance. So clearly, you're not getting involved in an election for or against a candidate. He said that he and Senator Fumo had an appetite for this type of information, for this data. And he also confirmed to you that Ruth did not share in it. Tom Kiley testified and told you that the polls were informational, not a specific election. One dealt with criticisms of the mayor. Another dealt with the attitudes, public attitudes, regarding 13 people and organizations to try to figure out the possible shape of city council in the future. Take a look at your leisure at Government Exhibit 49 for comparison. This is a budget of Senator Fumo's staff for his own election. And for his own election, they budget $30,000 that Fumo for Senate has to pay, because that is in an election for or against a candidate. Now, reasonable people can surely debate the wisdom of citizens paying for these polls. There's no doubt about that. The polls are gathering information on people, organizations, issues, and future elections. That's what they're doing. And the person who will benefit by that information is Senator Fumo. Information, knowledge, or power. Now, why should they do that? They should do that because he is the primary benefactor of the organization. And it is simply true that the more educated he is, the more information he collects, the more effective he can be, effective as a legislator and effective as a benefactor to Citizens Alliance. If you have somebody who's got the proven capacity to put $17 million in your bank account, it's in your best interest to do anything and everything you can to keep them at the top of their game. What the real issue is, not whether you agree or disagree with that, the real issue is, did they violate the IRS prohibition against getting involved in a then and there election for or against a candidate? And the answer is simply no. And as I said yesterday, if we were wrong in making that statement, the head of the IRS would have been here to tell you so. Now, you've heard by this point from me, of course, from four government witnesses who are CPAs. We have explored with them the 990 instructions, and you've got the judge's jury instruction on this topic, pages 49 and 50, which hopefully is conclusive for your purposes. We simply weren't doing anything wrong. This is another example where there are clearly two ways to look at this. Is it a good thing for Citizens Alliance to make these hefty payments so that the person who is responsible for the bulk of their funding, $17 million in private money really dwarfs any public money they ever got. Is it a sensible investment in their future to keep him at the top of his game, to provide him with information that he needs so that he can be more effective as a legislature and on their behalf? The polls were taken as a deduction. You may recall the cross-examination of a couple of the CPAs, and it wound up like this. The deduction was simply meaningless. It was a $250,000 deduction on the Form 1120 for CA Holdings. CA Holdings had losses of $800,000. So it didn't matter whether they did or didn't take that deduction. If they didn't, they'd have losses of $550,000. This next issue, ladies and gentlemen, is the issue that I told you on October 22 we would eventually focus upon. On October 22, I said there are all these grandiose claims of $1.5 million in theft. And I made mention of the $400,000 on cars and the couple hundred thousand dollars on the development of Tasker Street. And I made mention of the War Dog and a few other things. But then I said, when all is said and done, here's what we're going to be talking about. And this is it. We're going to be talking about the government's position expressed in their exhibits 1015 and 1016. That's what we're going to be talking about. When the government presented their position to you, they told you that their investigative work demonstrated in those two exhibits $157,000 of thefts from Citizens Alliance by Senator Fumo. That's what they told you. What has happened since then? I told you on October 22nd that we got some things worth some money, but I also told you, I'd convince you, it wasn't $157,000. So what are the things that have happened? Well, in their zeal to present a six-figure document to you, first thing happened was a simple arithmetic error. And their first exhibit, 1015, really only adds up to $93,000 and not $115,000. The second thing that happened is we all learned together that the FBI agent who constructed that document was employing a methodology which, let's just say, was not reliable. Another way to have tackled that problem, which consumed 1,200 hours of an experienced FBI agent's time. Another way to have tackled the problem of whether Senator Fumo got this, that, and the other thing would have been to do exactly what they did in so many other contexts. They're not bashful about search warrants and subpoenas. You've heard so much about them in this trial. Search warrants at the Senate office at Lenny Lutchko's house, subpoenas for computers, subpoenas for documents, subpoenas for people, blah, 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 blah. It was on and on and on. They're not the least bit bashful. But in this instance, no effort was made to get a search warrant or a subpoena to go and see if any of these things they claim Senator Fumo got were in his house on Green Street, on Monmouth Avenue, on Kenyon Avenue, down in Florida, or anywhere. Nor did they attempt to see if they were at Citizens Alliance on Wharton Street. Instead of doing those simple things, which would not have consumed 1,200 hours of anybody's time, they spoke to Tracy Burris, and they gathered from Tracy that there were certain things that Citizens used and certain things that he didn't use, that Citizens didn't use. And there are multiple flaws in that. You learned from my examination of the agent that it wasn't just Tracy who went out and bought things. There were credit cards and lots of people's names and hands. So you're talking to one person out of a whole bunch of people who might know. And then the agent, from that point, constructed this system of going through 3,500 purchases, and she decided that a figure like 2,162 went to Senator Fumo and the rest went to Citizens. Now, they eventually changed that position because they didn't know whether these things went to Senator Fumo or went to some other person, like Christian DeSico or anybody else. But the way she did it, she came out with these improbable and impossible to defend results. You may remember the stack of examples that I had, and I exhausted about 25 of them and myself, and I think you. I could have done 2 days of that, but I thought you got the point. What she did with Tracy is a very fast review of her summary. She did not review with Tracy the actual receipts, the 1,705 pages of supporting data. The whole approach was flawed. And I worked out arithmetically, and I think I have it written down here, that if she did with Tracy what she says she did, she spent all of 12 seconds per entry with him. When I reviewed those examples, just to show you that there was simply no sense to her construct of this exhibit and her conclusion of $115,000, it is simply not true, as Mr. Zalzmer said yesterday, that my examples were limited to Home Depot. Some were. You remember me asking Tracy, was there ever a situation where you went to buy things for Citizen and one item in the purchase store was for Senator Fumo? No. That would be ridiculous. That never happened. And I showed Tracy three of these examples, and he said they were all wrong. And then I showed maybe 25 of them to the agent. Remember the tulip? A big, long list of items, and under the construct invented by the agent, everything goes to Citizen except the tulip, which goes to Senator Fumo. There were a whole bunch of them. But the ones that are really telling are the ones where all you had to do is look at Citizens Alliance work orders and letters from constituents and use some common sense. Some of my examples were actual Citizens work orders, and you could read the order and you could see why Citizens bought the stuff that day, yet it's allocated to Senator Fumo. Got a letter from a constituent saying, I live in this apartment on Passyunk Avenue, and I can't get the landlord to replace my air conditioner. You got to help me. And then we buy an air conditioner. 2 days later, they put the air conditioner on Senator Fumo's list. But the worst one of all was the Councilman Kenny example. To develop this one, I had to have the agent concede that she interviewed Councilman Kenny and prepared a 302 report, a lengthy one. And the lengthy 302 report said nothing about what I'm going to tell you. Nothing. Not a peep. Not a word. It did not say that Councilman Kenny told this agent that a widow in his district was broke and in the winter couldn't heat her apartment and needed a heater, and that he went to Citizens Alliance and they bought it, and that some local plumber also volunteered to do the work and to install some other appliance for her. Now, it wasn't in the 302, but I asked her about it because I knew it happened. So I asked her about it, and I asked her why she would put that on Senator Fumo's side, that this went to Senator Fumo. You see, if she didn't know about it, then maybe you could somehow understand that. But she knew about it. She admitted that she had spoken with Kenny, and that Kenny told her all this. And even hearing this from Councilman Kenny, she still puts it on Senator Fumo's side and makes a part of $115,000. That's the truly bothersome bothersome one. No matter how you look at that exhibit, 1015, it's not worth the paper it's printed on. Senator Fumo sat down with that exhibit and 1016 in a highlighter. As the eyewitness to the transactions, he drew a line indicating whether he got something or didn't get it. And we gave that to the government. And he testified. The truth here is that out of the whole $115,000, which is really $93,000, in a six-year period, he got goods, which had a value of $43,000. And the truth here is, as to Exhibit 106, in a 5 or 6 year period, he didn't get $42,000. He got approximately $20,000. $43,000 and $20,000 is $63,000. Divided by 6 years is $10,500 a year. Divided by 5 years is $12,600 a year. Mr. Zausmer said several times yesterday that the Citizens Alliance labor crew earns $10,000 to $15,000. That's wrong. The testimony in this case is that the lowest paid guy gets about $16,000. Senator Fumo got less than the lowest paid man on the labor crew for all he did for Citizens Alliance. Now, here's an interesting facet. The government had that. They had those exhibits. They have the backup data. 1015A is 1,705 pages. Then there's an A exhibit to 1016A, in fact, it's called. And I don't know how many pages that is. But they had all that. And they've had all that stuff for a long time, at least since the summer. Had all that. Did they even attempt to challenge Senator Fumo on what he got? Did they have a single example they could put under his nose? Did they have any kind of proof that he was anything other than 100% accurate and truthful? You saw what I did. You saw what I did with their own work product. You saw me demonstrate the illogical approach to figuring out what he got. They did nothing because he was right. He was completely right. They bowled you over with these big numbers, 115,000, 42,000. When I told you on October 22nd it wasn't true, I meant it. And we were able to show it to you two ways, by cross-examining their witnesses and by presenting our own unchallenged proofs. Mr. Zausmer can shrug it off and say, well, you know, okay, so it's 62,000. He still got something. But there's a big difference between us telling you the truth and it equaling $62,000 and then telling you that story. And I'll just be gracious and say that story, which is not accurate, totaling up to $157,000. There's a big difference there, a big difference. Now, let me pose a question to you. If you're trying to figure out the core issue on this topic, if you're in the jury room and you're trying to get to the bottom of this, what do we do about the admission by Mr. Jacobs, by Senator Fumo, that over a six-year period, Senator Fumo got goods, drills, hammers, washers, hot dogs, that totaled up to $63,000. What do we do about that? No witness in the case, as Mr. Jacobs pointed out, no witness in the case has taken the stand and said to us it is improper or illegal for a 501c3 to give a gift to its benefactor. So what do we do about this? How do we approach the problem? A way to start the discussion might be, and I'm not trying to tell you what to do, I'm just throwing out an idea. First point might be, is the guy entitled to anything? We've been listening to witnesses for 4.5 months. Is he entitled to anything? Or, on the other hand, is he not entitled to anything and just siphoning off assets for no reason? That might be a way to start. Because if he is siphoning off assets for no reason, if that's what he's doing, then that is stealing. If he's taking their stuff for no reason, just because he wants it, then I agree with the government. That's stealing. But on the other hand, if he's entitled to something, it's not stealing. Then we got to figure out if we got a paperwork problem, if the CPAs were as helpful as they should be, and so on. And I'm going to make a couple of suggestions to you, if you don't mind. Maybe you should not be sidetracked by this whole ethics issue. Now, this is really Mr. Kogan's fight, more than it is mine, but we're accused right along with him of this $1.5 million theft. Now, this ethics thing, I was listening to Mr. Pease reading these ethics opinions, and Mr. Contino, very nice fella, telling us about ethics, and Mr. Kogan's cross-examination or direct examination of his own client. Listening to all these ethics opinions, and this case, whatever Senator Fumo got, was it intended to influence his vote in anything? Was it intended to affect the way he does his job as an elected state senator? Is there we talk about political corruption. What's this got to do with political corruption? He's a senator. But we're getting led down this warm trail of ethics problems. There's nothing that was done by Ruth or by citizens, a separate entity, to influence Senator Fumo on any vote or in his conduct as a legislator. Anything we gave him out of gratitude. We're not trying to buy votes. This is not a political corruption case. And if you remember my cross-examination of Mr. Contino, admittedly an ethics expert, I produced for him a second ethics act. He had one. I had one. It's not like my ethics act. It's a law in Pennsylvania. But I was using one and he was using another. And I pointed out to him that his ethics act applies to everybody who works for the state. Everybody. My ethics act only applies to the senators and the representatives. It's much more focused. It applies to the General Assembly. All right? First, his is a general law. The second, mine, is a specific law. And I said to him, don't you know, as a lawyer, it's one of the first things they teach us in legislation, in law school, which I attended a few years ago, don't they teach you that when you're confronted with a general statute and a specific one on the very same topic, you're supposed to conduct yourself according to the general, to the specific one? And he said, yes, you're right. As a general principle, you're right. And of course I'm right. It's a basic fundamental proposition of legislative construction. In a general statute, a specific statute, you go with the specific statute. Why is that important in this case? Because in the specific statute, there is a section which says the prohibition against taking gifts doesn't apply if it's from a not-for-profit corporation. What it says, it doesn't apply if it's from a not-for-profit corporation. So now we got, in addition to all our other problems, two ethics acts to deal with. But again, this really isn't an ethics issue. I'm going to suggest that you also don't get sidetracked by these questions about whether Senator Fumo reported on his financial disclosure forms or income tax returns any of these gifts. He's got his position. The government's got their position. But he's not charged with any of that. He's not charged with not reporting this on his income tax. He's not charged with not disclosing this on an ethics form. So then I'd say to myself, if I were trying to get to the bottom of this, did he do work? What's the tangible, concrete evidence in this case that he did work? Because you should only get paid for work. What is it? And I might answer to myself, well, he got the great idea on PICO, multi-skillion dollar corporation, swimming in money. He got an idea which caused them to fork over $17 million. Not a bad idea. That was good work. And then he tried to do it with Verizon. Tried, unfortunately failed. But that's okay. He may succeed the next time there's a rate increase made by some utility. Passyunk Avenue revitalization. What did he do there? Well, according to the emails, he was the final arbiter of what property to buy and how much to pay, because he grew up in real estate. Christopher Columbus Charter School. He got the idea. He assigned it out to Ruth to be the owner's representative. All this police stuff, helicopters, vans, what do you call those jack things to keep you from getting your car getting stolen. Televising the mummers. He was instrumental in all this stuff. He did real hard work. Look at this $17 million. The CPAs told you that fundraisers for not-for-profits take commissions. The average is 24%. Apply that to $17 million. You've got almost $4.25 million. He didn't get that. He didn't ask for it. He didn't want it. We didn't give it to him. If you look at line 30 on any 990 we ever filed, which says fundraiser fees, look at any we ever filed, zero, zero, zero. Everybody else shells out at least 24% of what they take in to raise funds. We shell out zero. He did that for us. That's $17 million. What did it get turned into? Well, in one example, I'll just give you two. In one example, it got turned into the Christopher Columbus Charter School. I said before, $5.5 million. What are we getting out of that? $27,000 a month. Cool cash rent. That's what we're getting. It's like $340,000 a year return on that $5.5 million. 6%. You can't beat it. The properties on Passyunk Avenue, they all have value, and eventually the value will go up. The incubator project, which did not work, we sold and made $700,000. This is what he did for us. This is what he did for citizens. Ruth would have to be brain dead to not understand the beneficence and the future that citizens had with Senator Fumo. It's so obvious, you know. I feel funny having to even explain it. If you don't want to take care of this guy, who are you going to take care of? Just the simple interest at 2% on that $17 million, just that, if they chose to put it in a passbook savings account, would be $340,000 a year. Now, if we could rewrite the history of Citizens Alliance and its relationship with Senator Fumo, starting with the receipt of the first $1 million in PICO money, I want to give you some examples of how we would rewrite it so that we could avoid the pleasure of your company for 4.5 months in a federal courtroom with an indictment hanging over our heads. What we could do in 1998, when the first $1 million comes in, we could get Senator Fumo a $25,000 gold Rolex watch and inscribe it. Senator Fumo, thanks for all you've done, CABN. And we could give it to him in a little ceremony. And on our books, there would be a check written for it, or there would be a charge account slip for it. And that $25,000 would show up somewhere on our 990, maybe line 43, other expenses. And nobody would blink at that. And he would have a $25,000 Rolex. Then the next year, when another million rolls in, we could rewrite history and not buy him tools and hamburger buns 1999, will throw an elaborate affair in his honor, 300 people at a hotel ballroom in Philadelphia, and we'd pay $100 a head for this sumptuous dinner and hire a band and we'd advertise it. We'd spend $50,000, and all those checks would be in our Quicken or whatever you call it, and everything we charge would be in our charge accounts. Everything would show up in line 43 or so, and nobody would blink at it. In 2000, for something different, we could take out a full-page ad in the Philadelphia Inquirer, his favorite newspaper. Thank you for everything you've done for us. Thank you. Spend $15,000 on that. These things are expensive. That check, the Philadelphia Inquirer, that would be right in our Quicken books. Nobody would blink at it. In 2001, for something different. See, 2001, I think it's another million. I think it's 2002 that the 10 million comes in. 2001, for something different. We could send him and his son and his younger daughter to a conference on public, private fundraising in a nice venue like San Francisco and spend $10,000 on that. And the airline tickets, the hotel reservations, limousine, it would all be in our books. Our Quicken, line 43 on the 990. That's right. And nobody would blink at that. And lastly, one last one. When the 10 million comes in, we want to do something special. 2002. We endow the already existing Fumo Family Library on Broad Street. We endow it for $150,000 to do with what they want. And nobody would blink at it. And so on, and so on, and so on. But what did we do? $63,000 for a guy who doesn't want or need or ask for anything. We tell him, you know, what do you want? What can we do? Here's what I like. I like tools. I work with my hands. I like screwdrivers. I like power tools. I like these lights that you put where you can't get them, where you can't get the stuff, you know. And we do buy him all these things over a 5 or 6 year period that add up to $63,000, and we're getting crucified for it. We could have done all this other stuff, every bit of it, and it would never see the inside of a courtroom. But we did something untraditional, and we did something a little bit different. That's what we did. Now, one of the things we did is, as a courtesy, sometimes a small courtesy, sometimes a big courtesy, citizens, laborers dropped off Christmas tree decorations, shoveled snow, picked up garbage, and did go down to Ventnor. I told you yesterday that while the government says it's gluttony, the witness says it's 1% of his time. But I want to put this in perspective. However much time it was to pick up the Ventnor trash, shovel the walks, and on, however much time that was. Mr. Zalzmer is right. However much time it was, that same time could have been dedicated to cleaning a lot. That is true. But so is this. $17 million will clean lots for 15 years or more. And he got some usage of a car. Whether it was a lot or a little, he had usage of the town and country. At your leisure, take a look at Government Exhibit 1315, pages 22.1, and 28. And these are the schedules of these cars and their depreciation. And when you're looking at them, so that you confirm that I'm right, that these cars were in fact depreciated, look particularly at page 28 and try to recall my examination of the CPAs where I made them admit that they were trying to allocate personal usage on these cars. how much personal usage any driver had. But they didn't exactly get around to doing it right. And they were falling down on the job and issuing 1099s for personal usage. So he got use of a car. It's not Ruth's fault. It's not his fault that the accountants didn't do what they probably should have. But he got usage of a car, which he was entitled. Now pretend that all of this stuff that I talked about, the hypothetical things, were done and appeared somewhere in the tax returns, maybe line 43, maybe line 30, and nobody would blink. And please ask yourselves, why are we making such a big deal? Because instead of an endowment to the library, instead of a Rolex watch, instead of a trip to San Francisco, instead of a full-page ad in the Inquirer, you got barbecue grills, tiki lights, power tools, screwdrivers, and washers. And when you're asking yourself that question, remember again, I mentioned this exhibit yesterday, and I'll mention it again today, Government Exhibit 1020, the computer program that he directed be installed on two computers, Joy Chern and Jamie Spagna, to keep track of what he got, what it cost, and what he paid for it. Now, I want to respond to an argument that, right, Judge?
It's kind of past what you said you were going, but I assume you're getting near the end.
I am. I have one topic after this, Judge.
Okay.
I want to respond to an argument that Mr. Zausmer made yesterday, because it is a neat argument. A neat argument. He said, Senator Fumo was trying to tell you that the things he got were gifts, and he didn't have to report them on tax returns. So, Mr. Zausmer, reasons. Isn't that ridiculous? You could go to your boss and say, boss, don't pay me anymore. Just give me gifts, but don't pay me. So I don't have to pay tax on these gifts. And that would be the collapse of the Internal Revenue Service in America, according to Mr. Zausmer. Now, that's a neat argument. Lawyers are taught those arguments. It's called reducing your adversary's position to an absurdity. That's what it's called. Now, constructing that argument often requires that you omit relevant facts or you change some facts. And your hope is that the listener will only remember the conclusion and not the differences between reality and your absurd example. And he executed it very well. Let's try it this way. In his example, there's an existing employer-employee relationship. That's quite different than here, isn't it? There was never an employer-employee relationship between citizens, Senator Fumo. So let's make this a situation where a not-for-profit in your town is struggling for money. And you're an affluent person. Maybe you own your own grocery store. Everybody's got to eat. So you want to support this not-for-profit. And you help them out. You help them out by helping them file applications for state grants. You help them out by filing applications for federal grants. You talk to politicians, try to get their support for this not-for-profit. You go to friends, coworkers, and you talk it up, and you say, look, give me a pledge. You don't have to pay it now. Give me a $1,000 pledge for 5 years. Give me a $5,000 pledge for 5 years. Give me a $10,000 pledge for 10 years. And you get them all these pledges. You go to some lawyers, and you say, look, I like this not-for-profit. They do good work. Can't you talk to your clients who want wills and ask them to make a charitable bequest? They're not going to miss the money when they're dead. Suggest they put them in for $5,000, $10,000, $25,000. And then you go out and you arrange a fundraiser and you make them $15,000 bucks. $20,000. And when they got some money, you negotiate the purchase of some real estate so they can put up an office building. And you help them with all that. And they want to do something for you. They say, look, not-for-profits can pay fundraising fees. We'd like to cut you in for 20, 30%. But being the noble person that you are, you say no. Well, let us put you on the payroll. Let us put you on the payroll as a coordinator. No. Well, can't we do anything for you? And you say, well, I do like expensive French and Italian wines and champagnes. And my spouse and I have always wanted his and her Piaget watches. And I do like the Hummer 3. And by the way, it would be an enormous convenience if some of the people who work on your labor crew would be nice enough to shovel my walk and pick up my trash. And all that happens. Now, you see the difference between Mr. Zausmer's absurdity? Mr. Zausmer starts with an existing employer-employee relationship, converts it into a no-pay 35-hour-a-week job, and substitutes gifts. And my example, which sounds like it makes some sense and sounds like this case. There would be no problem with any of that. This case was investigated very aggressively, as I'm sure you know. I figured out. And it's been going on for 5 years. Do you think that the investigators in this case, I'm going to ask you 9 questions. Do you think that the investigators in this case even knew that fundraisers are entitled to fees and the average is 24%? Do you think that the investigators in this case knew that the CPAs who ultimately testified in this case never did a line-by-line review of the tax returns with Ruth, which I made them all admit? 3, do you think the investigators in this case grasped the import of Ruth saving the 6 or 7 emails from Senator Fumo ordering goods from Granger and elsewhere to be paid by Citizens Alliance, saving them for years? 4, do you think the investigators in this case had any understanding of this concept of what is an excess benefit transaction? None of the accountants did, except for Mr. Gallagher, who learned it after this case, and Mr. Beckman, who was the first CPA not involved in the relevant years. Do you think the investigators in this case knew that the Stockton-Bates accountants couldn't even define the term excess benefit transaction, which is what we're talking about and what Senator Fumo got? 6, do you think the investigators in this case knew that the accountants never asked either side, Ruth or Senator Fumo, about anything that Senator Fumo might be getting from Citizens when they were doing the returns for both? 7, you think the investigators in this case took a hard look at the accounting work done by Drucker and Scicchetti and Stockton Bates to form an opinion as to whether these CPAs knew what they were doing and were able to advise Ruth on these relevant issues? 8, do you think these investigators ever took a look at My Ethics Act, the one that specifically says gifts from a not-for-profit are accepted? And 9, do you think these investigators ever got an opinion from the Internal Revenue Service on where in the world you would list a gift on a 990 form, if you would list it at all? They had 5 years and lots of other opinions and lots of other data.
Judge, I have one last topic. Shall I proceed or
Oh, you know, I'm going to leave that up to you, Mr. Jacobs. Do you think that it's going to be long?
Well, Judge, it's not the length of it. It's not going to be real long, but I think maybe the jury could make use of a break.
Brief.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the jury should still have.
They probably can.
Yeah.
Okay. Take a break.
Leave your seat, our own.
The last thing I want to discuss with you is the topic of these tax returns and the CPAs who prepared them. Now, let me start off by saying that if there were an intent to hide something here, if Ruth wanted to hide things of value or money that she gave to Senator Fumo from Citizens, if she wanted to do that, you would have heard a much different case over these last 4 months if there were a scheme to hide. Think about it. $5.5 million in contracts and subcontracts on the two charter schools. You know how many opportunities that would have provided for intermediate contracts and to skim off money if we were looking to hide something? 20 Passyunk Avenue transactions, buying up properties through straw people. You know how many opportunities would have been there if we were looking to hide something to get some money into Senator Fumo's pocket? Cash. We had a petty cash fund with $300-$400 a week in it. How easy it would have been to skim off $250 a week and get them $10,000 a year if we were looking to hide something. We didn't do any of those things. That's what you would have heard about if there were an effort to cheat on the tax returns and hide things. Everything here is on a charge account, paid for a check. It's all in the books. His getting power tools and electrical equipment is known to the Citizens Alliance employees. They talked about it. It's known to Senate staff. It was known to Jamie Spagna. It's known to the laborers. It was known to Matt Fonseca. It was no secret. You would have heard an entirely different case if we were looking to conceal things of value going to Senator Fumo. And these payments of $3,250 to Frank Wallace, somebody made a judgment that Citizens should pay part of his fees. Whether that judgment was because of his efforts to surveil the banner that was getting torn down or his efforts to see who was distributing anti-Citizens Alliance literature in City Hall or what, who knows. Somebody made a judgment that Citizens should pick up $3,250 of his bill. And they wrote a check. They didn't do it in cash. They didn't do it any sneaky way. They just wrote a check. Maybe it's an error in judgment. Maybe. But it's not a crime. Howard Kane, on November 6, referred to Ruth as a bookkeeper. Art Emilio, one of the CPAs, referred to Ruth as a bookkeeper. But he went a little further. Not a very good bookkeeper. Ruth is not a CPA. She's not capable of completing a 990 or an 1120. And she doesn't have to be because Citizens paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, $62,000 to one firm, $408,000 to another firm, to do these things. Now, these CPAs that testified, they were private sector CPAs. They're not FBI agents who are accountants or CPAs. They're private sector CPAs. And they were neutral witnesses. They're not committed to one side or the other. And by and large, they were quite decent people. They made appropriate concessions. When errors were pointed out, they agreed they made errors. They didn't try to defend them. And they were all experienced to different degrees. At least one was a specialist. The others were not. Now, before I talk about them individually, I want to respond to Mr. Zausmer's statements that this case is not about CPAs, and then he went on to say, I'll dispose of that in 2 minutes. Those remarks suggest to me he did not appreciate the reasons for the cross-examination or the substance of the cross-examination. It was intended to show you that highly trained CPAs who have passed an arduous exam and have 10, 20, and 30 years in the field made serious errors because this is a murky and complex field of accounting. Let me just show you his examples, which he poo-pooed as silly, was the word he suggested. Mary, can we get Exhibit 13, 14 up for the jury, page 23? These are the instructions for the preparation of a 990 form. Now, Mary, what I'm going to want to look at first is the instructions for line 31. So that'll be the left-hand column, and you have to go toward the ceiling. There you are. Now, what this says, just bear with me there for a minute so I can get it in a form I can read. What this says, and these are the instructions that tell a CPA how to fill out the 990 form. There's an instruction for every line. Line 31, accounting fees. Enter the total accounting and auditing fees charged by outside firms and individuals who are not employees of the reporting organization. That is fairly clear, isn't it? If you are a CPA reading that, would it not tell you that on line 31, you are to put your own fees, your own accounting fees? Okay? Now let's move on to line 43. Mary, if you could focus in on 43 and maybe make it a little bigger. Line 43 says other expenses, and I'm focused on the first paragraph. Show the type and amount of each significant expense for which a separate line is not provided. Now, that should clue you in right there because a separate line is provided for accounting fees. But it goes on. Report all other miscellaneous expenses on a single total. Expenses that might be reported here include investment counseling and other professional fees, but not professional fundraising fees, accounting fees, or legal fees. Now, you're not CPAs, but you understood what I just read. Line 31 says that's where you put your accounting fees. Line 43 says that's where you don't put your accounting fees. If you pay $408,000 to an accounting firm, don't you think they should understand these basic instructions and follow them? And you got two accounting firms who put their accounting fees on line 43 where they're not supposed to be. Now, you can call that silly, but you can also call it something else. You can call it negligent. You can call it not reading, not doing your job, not reading the instructions and following them. You can call it a mistake. And it is a mistake, and they admitted it was a mistake. One more. Counsel gave you another example. And this is page 28 of the same form, line 84A, instructions. It's another mistake made by both accounting firms. Line 84A, solicitations of contributions. All organizations that qualify under Section 170C to receive contributions that are deductible as charitable contributions for federal income tax provisions enter, quote, NA, close quote. Both accounting firms read these instructions, which plainly say the IRS wants to see NA if your Section 170 approved, and we were. Both accounting firms ignored this, and they typed in no. Yes, you can call it a little thing, but again, for $62,000, $408,000, you can also call it negligence, not following the simple rules. Highly trained professionals not following simple instructions. So it is about the accountants in part, and I'm not going to blame everything on the accountants. I'm just saying there's enough blame to go around here in this complex area. Let me talk to you a little bit about the individual accountants because it's been a long time. Ronald Beckman testified December 4th and 9th of last year. Very educated guy, very impressive guy. He's got a master in law degree, CPA, 1974. He teaches 501c3 practice. He is a specialist. And he's the guy who told you when he was called in 1996, Citizens had no accounting system, no payroll. It took him 3 years to get them straightened out. He's also the guy who defined for you for the first time what is political activity. And he's also the guy who defined for you what is lobbying activity. And he is also the guy who identified or was shown Defense Exhibit 770-12 and who read it and who said, well, this is good. You made your this is the broadest possible set of purposes. You've opened it all up. Now, interestingly, to show you how complex this area is, he is also the man who looked at the IRS instructions for the 990 and told you the IRS incorrectly defined political activity because the IRS included the word appointment. And that's just plain wrong. Not-for-profits can put all the money they want into appointed offices. You know, in some states, judges get appointed. People get appointed to commissions, like the Turnpike Commission. Well, a not-for-profit can spend all the money they want on promoting an appointment or opposing an appointment. And he pointed out to you, and he teaches 501c3s, even the IRS instructions contained an error by including the word appointment. His words were, it's a murky and complex area. When I asked him about his law students, he teaches this to law students. You know, some do well, some don't do well, some fail. So law students have trouble with this. You can't hold Ruth to a very high burden on complex concepts like this. They're not the simple questions. You know, questions like what special assistance to individuals enter direct or indirect political expenditures? Did the organization engage in any Section 4958 excess benefit transactions? During the year, is the organization either directly or indirectly engaged in any of the following acts with any substantial contributors, trustees, creators, or with any taxable organization with which any such person is affiliated as an officer, director, trustee, majority owner, or principal beneficiary? Payment of compensation. Well, what's compensation? Is that a gift? Or payment or reimbursement of expenses of more than $1,000? Expect Ruth to be able to navigate through all this. I mean, this is why the organization paid those hundreds of thousands of dollars. Our next, and by the way, this is also the gentleman who gave you the only coherent explanation of excess benefit transactions. Now, keep in mind, he was off the job by 1999, and therefore, he would not be in a position to really address whether anything that Vince Fumo got from Citizens was or should have been recorded. It's really the next group of accountants who were there during the relevant years. And they start with Mr. Cabasa, a CPA for over 20 years in a 100-year-old accounting firm. And I say that because Citizens didn't go out and hire some schlepper so that we could later say, the schlepper didn't understand. We went and hired the best people that we could and 100% relied on them. He's got an MBA in addition to a CPA. He is the accountant, both for Senator Fumo and for Citizens. Every one of these accountants, every one of them, did you discuss with either party, Citizens, Ruth, or Senator Fumo? Did you talk to them? Did you discuss with either party whether Senator Fumo was getting anything? And the routine answer was no. Didn't discuss it with either side. Unfortunately, Mr. Cabasa had literally no experience. So what he did is he just read the 990 instructions, something you or I could have done. Having only that minimal acquaintance with the field, he is the author of the statement, anything that has to do with politics is forbidden. Plainly wrong. And he is one of the CPAs immersed in the dialogue with the lawyers over what they should do with the polling expenses. He is also the person who introduced into this case the issue of the lost email. Now, this is somewhat important because we've got a couple of accountants saying that they emailed Ruth and they said, tell us what this polling stuff is about. And they say that Ruth emailed back, it's community consulting or community development consulting or something like that. Now, the government, of course, was interested in seeing if that email existed. The accountants could...
I thought I heard somebody talking out there, did you? Mr. Higgins, if you tell him to be quiet, the jurors heard. The jurors heard, and I heard, too, and I have lousy ears, so...
I'm on it.
Okay, Mr. Jacobs.
Mr. Higgins is squelching the talkers. The government, of course, was interested in getting that email, and they couldn't, which is curious. These CPAs produced hundreds, if not thousands, of documents, but they couldn't produce a copy of that email. Then they turned over their computer to be imaged by the government, and it wasn't there either. Now, I'm not making any allegations, but I am going to say this is the same accounting firm where another one of the accountants, Bart Emilio, lied to his boss, whose name is John Gallagher, and lied to Ruth about setting up bogus offsetting accounts receivable to account for the polling. And he sheepishly had to admit deceiving his boss and Ruth. But I don't know, and you don't know. They say she sent such an email, but the government can't produce it. Not on their computer, not in their file, but they say that it happened. As I mentioned earlier, a reasonable doubt about anything can arise not just from the evidence, but from the absence of some evidence. He is the first CPA who told you that this polling deduction would have simply been swallowed up by the $800,000 in losses. Just didn't matter. Didn't affect the tax return one little bit. And he did tell you directly, and I have to modify this a little bit, that he did not discuss compensation of Senator Fumo with either side. And when I say either side, I specifically asked him about Roseanne Pocciello, because that's who he dealt with doing Senator Fumo's tax return, not Senator Fumo. I don't think he ever talked to Senator Fumo. So what he actually said is he never discussed with either side, Ruth or Roseanne, anything that may have gone to Senator Fumo. He also said there was no line-by-line review of the tax returns with Ruth, and he also was unable to define for us what is an excess benefit transaction, and that's what this whole thing is about. Whether Senator Fumo is a disqualified person, in other words, an insider, and whether he got an excess benefit transaction, in other words, more than he was entitled to. That's what this is all about. And should he then, or should Citizens then, have to file a 4958 form and pay an excise tax? That's what this is really about. And that's what would happen if it was anybody other than Senator Fumo. Art Emilio is the next fella. He's the person who said Ruth was not such a hot bookkeeper. He identified himself as a CPA generalist with 20 years experience. He is the gentleman who set up absolutely nonsensical offsetting accounts receivable so he could balance the books on the polling entry. He admitted that what he did was wrong. He admitted that it was not allowed, no matter what set of rules you apply, AICPA, FASB, or GAAP. It was wrong, he shouldn't have done it, and he did it. That's why I say there's a lot of blame to go around here. And counsel says it's not about the CPAs. Well, you heard what he said. You heard he admitted all this. He then conceals it from Ruth, conceals it from his own boss, and admits he has no idea what is an excess benefit transaction. No idea, which is what this is all about. He also tells you he did no line-by-line review with Ruth and never said to her, did Senator Fumo get anything? Last comes John Gallagher, the boss at Stockton Bates. He is a 30-year CPA. 30 years. Three decades. In his words, and this is very close, this polling issue was all new to him and required research. He had no idea what to do with it. And here's an interesting thing. To me, this was maybe the single most interesting thing in the whole trial, except when I found out from the car salesman the truth about that $100 over a dealer's cost thing on the car. In his direct testimony, John Gallagher gave us an erudite lecture on what is an excess benefit transaction. And I listened to him, and I said, my goodness, this is chapter and verse, right out of the IRS statute, the regs, and the governing revenue ruling. I said, he must have read this revenue ruling, which gives you 21 examples of this and that and the other. I said, this guy really knows what he's talking about. And I got to cross-examine him. Revenue ruling 2007-41. I got to cross-examine him. I said, Mr. Gallagher, you've defined an excess benefit transaction very, very well here. I said, you've been an accountant 30 years. I said, when did you study all this? And he said, 3 years ago. So I said, in other words, you learned all this after 2005. Is that right? And he says, yes, I learned this as a result of what happened in this case. And I said to him, this question drew an objection. I said, Mr. Gallagher, in other words, you're telling the jury that for the first 27 years as a CPA, you did not know what an excess benefit transaction is. You couldn't define it. Counsel objected. The objection was overruled, and he had to answer. He said, that's right. So I followed up, and I said, during all this relevant period from 1999 through 2005, you did not know what an excess benefit transaction was while you were doing all this work. While you were doing all this work for Citizens Alliance, you couldn't even define the term, right? And it was right. So you got three out of three CPAs who couldn't even define the term while they were filling out these tax returns. Is that the proper level of assistance that Ruth should have been getting from CPAs who bill $408,000? And he, too, when I asked him, he said, we never asked about any benefits that Senator Fumo may have gotten. Then, this is ironic. He is the author of a letter, Exhibit 1362, in 2005. And it's even more ironic because Mr. Zausmer showed it to you on the screen yesterday. Mr. Gallagher writes a letter in 2005, and he has a paragraph in there, and he says to Ruth in this paragraph, I want you to give me all the information you have on possible excess benefit transactions. This is in 2005. This is all water under the bridge. If there were excess benefit transactions, they happened in 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, and 2004. Mr. Gallagher didn't even know they existed. He had never studied them. He couldn't define the term until 2005. So he writes this CYA letter after everything has happened and is done and over, and he sends it to Ruth. Tell me everything you know about excess benefit transactions. And Mr. Zausmer shows it to you as proof this is all Ruth's fault. three accountants out of three. The chief issue in this case is, did the stuff that Vince Fumo got for all his good work for Citizens qualify as an excess benefit transaction, yes or no? And we got three CPAs who can't define the term. A lot of effort went into cross-examining the CPAs so that I could say to you today, they made a lot of mistakes, so why not this one? Didn't they fall down on the job in this area where Ruth is being accused of botching the tax returns? Drucker and Schicchetti, this is Mr. Beckman. He was by far the most learned of the accountants. Remember, I had cross-examination books for these fellas. Now, real quick, in one line each. In the tax returns that Mr. Beckman's firm did for Citizens, their year-end and beginning year balances did not match. They were off by hundreds of thousands of dollars in some instances, and that's an impossibility. What you have on December 31, you have on January 1, and they were off by hundreds of thousands of dollars. Two, it's question 84, which you just saw on the screen, where the instructions so plainly say you answer not applicable, and they don't follow the instruction. Three, he knows from his own records, which I show him, that there are at least two DeChicos working for Citizens. So they are relatives, and you're required to recite their compensation if it's over 1,000. And it is, and he misses it every year. Four, his $62,000 in accounting fees do not go where they're supposed to go on line 31. The instructions plainly say that. They are buried in a long schedule attached to line 43. And he admitted this was all wrong. He admitted it. He made the appropriate concessions. And you know what these, do you remember what I said to these accountants? I said, isn't it a general practice among good CPAs to put two sets of eyes on every tax return? Yes, and we did. So all of this got by two CPAs, and they indict Ruth for these mistakes. Stockton Bates. Six, demonstrable, conceded errors. Number one, what I just said, the instructions on the 990 form, before the 994, very clearly say, if you're Section 170C approved, which we are, you got to answer question 84, not applicable. You just have to read the instruction. And they do it, and they do it wrong. They do it wrong. Schedule A to the 994, which is your historical schedule, what you got for preceding years. 2 years in a row, they leave off $1 million, and then they catch it in the third year. Three, there's interest income. There's a line for interest income. They have interest income, and they miss it. Four, there's a specific line, 22, for grants and allocations. All you have to do is read the instructions. And it says, you put all grants and allocations on line 22. Where do they put them? 43. You know why? Because it's easy. Take a look at the form. And what you're going to see is, for $408,000, instead of following the instructions and doing things right, they just make up a list of expenditures and they attach it. I think it's Schedule 3. And they attach it. They say on line 43, see Schedule 3, and they attach it, and they list a whole bunch of expenditures. So instead of following the instructions and put accounting fees where they're supposed to be and grants and allocations where they're supposed to be, they save some time, and they just make up this schedule, and they put it on line 43. You know, you can call it silly, but you can also call it negligence. You can also call it falling down on the job. You can also call it not giving your client the type of assistance and instruction your client should get. Five, rent from the Christopher Columbus Charter School, very hefty rent, put on the wrong line. It's supposed to be on line 2, it's on line 6A. And the account, same problem with the accounting fees, number 6. So I did all that, put a lot of time into it, just so I could stand here today and say, you make your decision. Did they dot every I? Did they cross every T? Is it fair to hold us to such a high standard on correct answers to these tax return questions, when the highly paid, highly trained, state-licensed CPAs made even more errors. They make all these mistakes on the tax returns, and they're mistakes. We make a mistake, and it's a crime. On these tax counts, if you find that Ruth was negligent or made a mistake, or this was accidental or anything else, or she acted in good faith, then obviously, she's not culpable. She's not guilty of any of this. What really happened here is the CPAs prepared these returns. And you know all the mistakes I just read to you, six with one firm, four with the other? Ruth signed those returns with all those mistakes. $1 million missing here, interest income missing there, accounting fees buried in 43 instead of being on 31. And she signed these returns with all these mistakes because they never reviewed them with her. And they just said sign. The testimony from these accountants was she would get these returns 24 hours before they were due. And she's supposed to pick through these and make sure excess benefit transactions are properly covered. No line-by-line review, no reaction time, no meaningful consultation, no understanding of what an excess benefit transaction is. And you've got CPAs who just don't understand the polling issue and don't know whether it's a political expenditure. This is all about where you record whatever it is that Senator Fumo got. It's all about defining what a political expenditure may be. I said we were going to be at this point on October 22nd talking about this issue, 157, which is now 63, and how you handle the tax return and whether the CPAs gave us the proper guidance. And that's where we are. That's where we are. So look, now you've heard our side of the story, Ruth and I. I can't tell it like the prosecutor tells his side of the story, because what he has is a theory of prosecution. He has this 250-page indictment that he wrote out a couple years ago stating his entire theory, his entire story of the prosecution. So he can stand here and he can express his entire theory to you. But it's only a theory. I don't have a countervailing theory. I can tell you what actually happened in 18 different areas, which is what I've been doing for too long now. And I'm asking you to say to yourselves, when you're in that jury room, and after you've heard the judge explain this concept of reasonable doubt to you, this is a durable concept. We're 200 years old. First thing I'd like you to say to yourselves when you start discussing what's the fair outcome in this case is Mr. Jacobs right or wrong that at least on these 18 points, there are two ways to look at this? There are two constructions of the evidence. Is he right or wrong about that? If you answer that question, yes, that is clearly a reasonable doubt, and you're done. But there's another question, and that's embedded in this durable principle the judge will explain to you. I said this once before. Before I sit down, let me say it once again. There's a million ways to define what is a reasonable doubt. There's a million ways. A popular one among lawyers is you're leaving on vacation, the whole family in the car with the trunk loaded, and you're two blocks from the house, and your spouse says, "Did you unplug the coffee pot?" And you say, "Yeah." Then two blocks later, you say, "I think I did." And you're two blocks further, you say, "We better go back." You had a reasonable doubt. Not some made-up imaginary doubt. You had a reasonable doubt. And when the judge delivers the charge, he's going to say something different. He's going to say, if you're looking at this evidence and it makes you, it's a type of evidence that would make you hesitate in your important affairs, it would make you hesitate, that's a reasonable doubt. Ladies and gentlemen, most of the evidence in this case should not only make you hesitate, it should make you turn your back and run the other way as fast as you can. This is an overblown, overreaching prosecution that should have never got this far. This case should have been an IRS conference and nothing else. And there should have been a decision by some hearing officer as to whether we got to pay an excise tax for political expenditures, whether we got to pay an excise tax for excess benefit transactions. But because Senator Fumo has his fingerprints on the case, the assumption, the overriding assumption, is everything he touches and does is wrong, which is how we get here. That's it. That's all I can do for my client. The rest is up to you. I want to thank you very, very much for staying with me for a day and a half. I know it's much longer than I promised, but that is another old lawyer's trick. You know, we say 3 hours, and then we spend 3 days. But thank you very much. You've been attentive, and we appreciate it.
And I would note, members of the jury, that in this case, I didn't put any limits on the counsel's time like I do in a routine case. This isn't a routine case. So I gave them the opportunity to talk as long as they think it's advisable for their client's benefit. Mr. Jacobs did happen to say yesterday that he was going to be shorter than he was, but don't hold that against him. It's very difficult sometimes to condense these arguments into a fixed time period. I'm not going to make you any promises about this case anymore because every promise I have made has not been not even close. I can't believe how wrong I've been in every estimate I've made here as to what's going to happen. But if I were to make you a promise, I would promise you that by Tuesday, you'll get this case start deliberating. Now, if you're holiday conscious, about 2 weeks before St. Patrick's Day. But that's the only promise I would make if I were going to make the promise. Now, you're excused until Monday at 10 o'clock.
Your Honor.
What do you walk on?
Can I address one thing?
Yeah. Counsel, Mr. Zalzmer is making a request of some kind.
Your Honor, I have one objection, if I may.
Oh, yeah.
Regarding the closing. Regarding this issue concerning the Legislative Code of Ethics and the Ethics Act, Your Honor will recall that we asked for a jury instruction regarding some legal principles regarding the interrelationship of those two acts that Mr. Jacobs addressed in his closing. And he addressed it erroneously. And he erroneously discussed Mr. Contino's testimony regarding it. And it's exactly the concern that we had. Your Honor, within your discretion, shortened what we had proposed regarding the Ethics Act, gave some of it, but not the part that addresses the interrelationship of these two acts. And in fact, there's a supremacy clause in the Ethics Act, and that's what Mr. Contino talked about. And what I'd like, if it's all right with Your Honor, is to submit a very short writing to you this weekend and a proposed proposal, because it's the court.
You may submit a supplement to the charge, or you may submit it, and I'll consider it.
Now, you know, I said this, Your Honor, before in chambers. We were talking about my rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Mr. Jacobs, I respectfully say, made many factual misstatements about the evidence. That shouldn't come from the court. But it's when he starts talking about a legal issue, it's the court's duty to instruct on the law, and that's why
you're right
to propose it.
There's no question about that, and so that's why I said you can submit
a
proposal for me to supplement my charge.
We'll get that in as soon as we can.
And, of course, you send a copy to the defense.
Of course.
Mr. Goldberger, you seem to be hovering around here. Do you have something on your mind? Or
hovering?
You're just hovering.
I thought we were leaving.
Okay, okay.
I came to hear him, that's all.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything else? Court is adjourned.
Judge, there was one thing. Well, dealing with this. What form of the indictment is going to be sent out?
Oh, yeah, of course.
We've been trying to deal with this right along, and Mr. Goldberger's been working on it. Maybe you can talk about it.
Well, you are going to have to submit your disagreements to me. In other words, I expect if you can't agree, I'll get a form they want. You'll give me a form you want, and I'll then rule on it.
Okay.
The other matter that I'm glad you brought that up, the other matter is the verdict slip itself. Both sides have submitted a proposed verdict slip, but I haven't heard anything else along those lines.
And we view that question as somewhat interrelated.
It's a related question.
If there is a more spare version of the indictment, perhaps a more verbose version of the verdict slip, and vice versa. The government submitted a lengthy indictment and a very spare verdict slip. We're going to propose the opposite, and we'll submit it to you.
So Your Honor knows where we stand. Mr. Goldberger is correct. Our proposal is that the redacted indictment be submitted to the jury. This is the charge. There are 137 counts. There's really no way for them to vote on these counts without knowing what they are. What Mr. Goldberger then did in response was prepared his version of the verdict sheet, which is really a severely redacted indictment. It's his rewriting of the indictment. We vigorously oppose that. The indictment's not written by him. It's approved by the grand jury.
Well, I would simply say that in the past, my practice has been to submit a redacted version of the indictment. And if there's any disagreements on what should be redacted, that's what I then rule on.
Right, and what Your Honor mentioned...
I haven't seen a redacted version yet, but...
Well, there won't be any misunderstanding. It was not our suggestion that the verdict slip, as supplemented in the version we submitted, go without any version of the indictment. So if that's what my friend is...
Well, then I may have misunderstood.
That's
that.
A misunderstanding.
Well,
I apologize.
Let's leave it with... you'll attempt to work out something you can agree upon, and if you can't, give me your final submissions, and I will make the decision on it.
We will do that. We understood, Your Honor, last week, you suggested about redacting and focusing on...
Well, I think you have to. Normally in a case of an indictment this size, some redacting is necessary.
And we did that.
In my experience in the past, I expected that to happen here.
We did. There are a handful of emails and things that are referenced that weren't introduced in evidence, and that's what we've done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you on Monday.
Thank you, Your Honor. Take your time, Ed.